stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'll be continuing to talk about our unconscious and how it protects us by using its various tricks from making changes that we're not yet ready to make, even though we don't know we're not yet ready to make them. And I'll be playing the first half of an interview I did with remarkable jazz pianist Mike Markovarich, who's blind from birth. So stay tuned. Here come the show. Show coming to you on Tuesday afternoons, 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and 3 o'clock on Mondays, if you happen to be in Europe. And I don't know what time it is if you're someplace else in the world. Well, I know what it is on the West Coast, because I spend so much time there. And if you're... So wherever you are, I'm so glad that you're here. This actually is a Tuesday morning. You know, I pre-record these shows. They're not live. So if you want to get in touch with me, and I hope that you do, you have to email me. You can go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and click on Contact Me, and it'll bring up an email, and you can get in touch with me. But that's the way you can do it. This is not a call-in, because I'm not actually there when you're listening to me. But I am here now. Oh, my God, Lynn. And this is actually a Tuesday morning. And I just returned from 4 days in New York City, where I go as often as I can. I'm one of those people who grew up in New York and still thinks of herself as a New Yorker. Although, by now, I certainly have lived longer outside New York City than I lived Well, I think it's about a toss-up. I'm about equidistant from the time I lived in New York to the time I've lived outside. But still, I think of myself as a New Yorker, and something special happens to me when I go home. I wonder if that's true for you. I know that that's true for a lot of people, that where they spent their early years, and I lived in New York a long time, maybe it depends on whether you liked it. I don't know. I liked it. So, I was just in New York for 4 days, and I got to go to the theater. I don't always get to go, but this time I did. Friends of mine have been telling me for months now that when I'm there, I need to see a play called August, Osage County. They would say to me, you have to see August, Osage County. I had no idea what those words meant. They didn't... August, Osage County. Okay, fine. What is that? Well, of course, it's the month of August in Osage County, which is in the Midwest, I think. I saw the play, but, well... Anyway, I badly wanted to see it because I've heard from people whose word I take how wonderful it is. But it's pretty new, and the person who has the starring role in it won the Tony, so I thought that tickets would be difficult to get. And I pretty much never pay full price to go to the theater. I go to TKTS, which, for those of you who have not been to New York, is a place where they will give you half price or quarter price, three-quarter price tickets to shows that are running when all the tickets haven't been sold. You go to this place in Midtown Manhattan, and there are often huge lines, and a couple of hours before the performance, if the tickets haven't been sold, TKTS tickets will sell them to you for less expensive than it would be to buy them at the box office. I've gotten into the habit of going to TKTS 20 minutes before performance because by then there are very few lines. In this case, there were no lines. Of course, some shows are sold out by then, but God, I went there and son of a gun, there it is, August, Osage County. 25% off. So I went up to the counter, and the ticket was $87. That's because at the box office it's $110. But I only had $84. And you have to pay cash. You can't, no credit card, no check, no traveler's check, no nothing, just cash. So I've got $84. TKTS is in the Marriott Marquis Hotel. And I happen to know, because this has happened to me before, that there's an American Express office there. So I went up to the American Express office, which was still open. I was so relieved. And I gave them my American Express card, and I said, I need some cash. Well, they will only give you cash if you have your driver's license or a passport. And I had left my driver's license in my hotel room. I had lots and lots of identification. None of that was good enough. The computer would only accept my driver's license or my passport. They said, go to the ATM. Now, I know that I am the last of a dying breed of people who has never used an ATM. But I went to the ATM, and it wouldn't give me money either. So I went back to the guy in American Express, and he said, go to the concierge. So I went to the concierge, and I told him my poor, sad story, and he gave me $5. And I went downstairs, and I bought my ticket. I bought my ticket from the same woman who had told me originally that I didn't have enough money. And when I had been there originally, she said to me, listen, I'm tired of giving. I can't buy anybody else's ticket. So clearly she's been doing that. And here the concierge at the Marquis, where I am not staying, gave me $5. And I wanted to tell this story to all of you who have heard the myths about New Yorkers. New Yorkers are, well, of course I'm speaking about myself, and so you have to forgive me, but New Yorkers are wonderful. They're generous, they're kind, they're helpful. They're wonderful. And so this is my New York love story for this morning. And August, Osage County, is a brilliant, brilliant play. I was so thrilled to have gotten a chance to see it. And I will, of course, send the $5 back to the concierge at the Marquis. And I'm going to send him a little present. Anyway, I wanted to tell you all that. Those of you who know didn't need to hear this, but those of you who are afraid of New York, don't be afraid. It's, well, of course, you know, you're listening. You're not talking. I'm talking. And you're listening to a person who's still very much in love with it. Okay, I guess. I have more to say about my trip to New York, but I will say it in another time, because I did other things. And one of the things I did was interview Elliot Roth. If you've been listening to the show, you heard me talk, I think, a couple of weeks ago about my trip to Pittsburgh, where I got to see Elliot Roth for the first time. And while I was in New York, where he was, I got to interview him, and I'm going to play that interview in 2 weeks, I believe. And I will talk more about my trip at that time. But now I'm going to talk about the unconscious and tell you another one of the tricks that it uses to protect us. Now, before I talk about the tricks in the bag of our unconscious and how it protects us, it occurs to me that I have said nothing about what to expect in this show. If you haven't been listening, so I'm just going to do a quick update. The first half of the show, I usually spend giving some information that comes out of my book. My book is called When You Can, You Will: Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And I'm working my way through the book. And in the second half of the show, I've been interviewing people in my series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist. And in the month of September, which I sure as hell hope you are, I've been specializing in interviewing pianists. And today, you will hear shortly the first half of an interview I did with Mike Markovarich, an amazing pianist, and also hear some of his music. But now, I'm still in the first half of the show and talking about our unconscious. And last week, I talked about the Freudian slip. And today I'm talking about another of our unconscious's common tricks, and that is forgetting to remember. Like Freudian slips, this is a common occurrence, something we've all experienced, but which most of us discount. For example, have you ever forgotten the name of someone you know really well just as you're about to introduce them? Have you ever torn apart a drawer or a pocketbook where you know you left your keys and can't understand why they're not there? Have you ever tried to dial a telephone number you've dialed 100 times, but suddenly you can't remember it? Yes, sometimes this just means you've got too much on your plate or that you're distracted. As Dr. Freud is supposed to have said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar and not a phallic symbol. But forgetting to remember can be a message from your unconscious that means something quite different. As when a client of mine forgot my name while trying to introduce me to her mother, who disapproved of therapy and didn't know the role I played in her daughter's life. I'm going to tell you a story about a client of mine named Carla. Carla came into therapy to, quote, make peace with her parents. She'd been at lunch with a friend, and Carla was talking about her mother and father, and suddenly her friend made a surprising observation about that relationship. Carla promised herself that at our next session, she would tell me what her friend had said. And when the time came, while she could recite the entire conversation, Carla couldn't quite recall the important part. Carla was very annoyed by this demonstration of her ability to forget to remember. Her conscious mind wanted to know the thing she'd forgotten. She knew it was important, and she wanted to tell it to me. Her annoyance turned to admiration, however, when she saw the remarkable talent her unconscious had displayed. It demonstrated its power to conceal information that her conscious mind had already seen. You see, it was one thing for Carla to discuss this with a friend, quite another to explore it with her therapist. She wasn't quite ready for that. To Carla, who'd always been skeptical about the existence and the power of her unconscious, the experience of having it act spontaneously on her behalf was a wonderful surprise. The next time you forget to do something you're sure you want to do or should do, try to resist the impulse to criticize or judge yourself, and instead ask yourself if this forgetting could have been orchestrated by your unconscious to protect you. So, are you thinking about the things that you have forgotten? Forgotten to remember? Or the slips of the tongue that you've made that were funny or surprising or embarrassing? Or your inner DJ? The songs that you hear that keep playing and playing in your head that you can't seem to get rid of? Are you beginning to think about the place that your unconscious has in your life, the ways that it communicates with you? Well, I have a big treat for you. While you allow your unconscious to percolate under there and maybe give you some ideas or some information or some thoughts, some intuitions that you haven't previously recognized, you can allow that to sort of, as I said, percolate while you listen to this first song that I'm going to play from Mike Markovarich's album, the CD called Solid, which you can get by going up on my website, thelynnshow.com, and that is L-Y-N-N-E. The first song I'm going to play from his CD is called Blame It on My Youth. It's a beautiful, beautiful standard. And it's entirely piano. Most of the songs on the CD are piano, bass, and drums. And I'll tell you who the bass player and the drummer are later. But this is solo piano, and it's just gorgeous. And right after this, I'm going to play the first half of the interview that I did with Mike. So here's Blame It on My Youth. Thank you.
put the digital. Okay, good.
Good.
So I am here with Mike Markovarich. Did I say that right?
Yeah, you did pretty well. It's
Markovarich.
You got it.
I imagine people struggle with it. Yeah.
You name it, I get it.
I'll bet you.
Every pronunciation you can imagine. And mispronunciation you can imagine. They do their best, but it's they don't always get it.
You're a kind man, Mike.
Well, it pays. It's worth it to be kind.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I believe it, although you wouldn't know that by some people's behavior.
Well, let's not go. I don't want to. Oh, boy.
So I'm here in Mike's office, which is outside of his studio, which is in his house. And Mike is a master pianist. I've seen Mike turn a room full of uninterested people into people who are screaming and jumping up and down and asking for more and more and more and more. He's not only a brilliant pianist, he's a remarkable entertainer. And so I don't have an agenda for these interviews, Mike. I am doing this radio show, and I'm doing this series called Anatomy of an Artist.
Oh.
And I'm just interviewing people who are making their living with their art,
mm-hmm.
people that I have reason to admire when I can talk to them, and I have tremendous admiration for you.
No, thank you.
You are welcome. So it's really just whatever you would want to say about how you found this, some stuff about yourself. You know, this is radio, so people aren't looking at you.
Right. Well, I can remember as about 3 years old, starting to listen to, we had, you might remember these TV consoles that had, it was a large cabinet, and it had a black and white TV in it, and it also had a turntable with an AM/FM radio built in.
I do remember.
You remember those?
I
well,
do.
Now I'm dating myself.
And me.
And my folks had one of those, and I used to love listening to the radio, and they also had 78 RPM records.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably remember those, but
I
not
do.
People 20 born in the 80s or in the 70s wouldn't remember those at all.
No, you remember
are.
The 33 and
oh, of course. I have boxes of them. But back when I was about 3 years old, I used to spend a lot of time listening to the radio or listening to Ken Griffin organ records. Do you remember Ken Griffin?
I do not.
He was one of the first to popularize the Wurlitzer electric organ as an instrument to record on.
Mm.
And his style was, it was very simple, very basic, sometimes three-note chords in the left hand, and he'd work the bass pedals, the foot pedals on the organ. You know, and he plays these simple chords in the left hand and just basically melody and bass, sometimes harmonize the melody a little bit in the right hand. And it was very straightforward, very simple style, but if you can imagine a three-year-old child, my hands weren't very big.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all I could do to try to figure out how to do that.
Are you serious?
I started playing when I was about 3 years old.
On a piano?
On a toy piano.
A toy, well.
I had a piano that was about knee-high. One of those little wooden
rinky-tink
pianos that sounds more like a xylophone than
yeah,
a piano.
I remember that.
Yeah, and then I had I graduated to a little pump organ that was about the same size.
Now, you were trying to duplicate this organ?
I was trying to just duplicate what I heard, the melodies and the simple chords.
Yeah, this is literally playing by ear.
Playing, well, learning by ear.
Learning, and, right.
I often, when people ask me if I play by ear, I say, well, no, actually, I use my fingers, but, which, of course, every time I think about playing by ear, I have this image that comes into my mind of my earlobe getting caught between the keys.
Yeah, right.
You know, not too comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I learn by ear. I still do
mm-hmm.
now. I learn off of recordings, or if I'm working with musicians that want to play a song often enough, and I work with them often enough, I learn it,
mm-hmm.
you know, just by hearing the chord changes and hearing what the melody's doing.
Now, do you know what you're playing? You know you're playing a C chord, you know you're playing an A minor?
Yes.
You
yes.
do? So they could also call
They could tell me
you.
About the chord changes, yeah, but then I would have to be able to hear where they're falling, you know.
You mean the voicing?
No, the placement. Because if you say, well, play A minor 7, how long do you want me to play A minor 7?
Yeah, right.
That's what I mean right. by where they're falling, how many measures.
I got it.
Or whether it's a half measure or, you know.
But if they called the chords to you as they were changing or right before they were changing.
Well, I wouldn't even have to. I could hear
you
that.
You could hear that.
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah,
right.
I could hear
right.
that. As long as the chords aren't ridiculously complex.
Right.
Once you start adding all kinds of jazz tensions into the chords, and if they're moving in a strange way, then maybe I won't hear it quite so well.
Right, or quite so quickly.
Or quite so quickly. Mm-hmm. The more complex tunes are harder to learn and take more time to learn.
Right.
In my teaching, I often tell my students, you know, some tunes, when you listen to a tune, you it catches you right away, and you see the melody catches you, you know, attracts your attention. You say, oh, I like this melody, this tune is just so nice.
Right.
So you gravitate toward that, and you learn the melody. So then you've got that much of it learned. Then you tackle the chord changes. Do you learn the chord changes? Then that's done. Then you put it together, and maybe it works. So other times, though, in my experience, and also in the experiences of some of my students, you run across a tune that's just plain hard, period.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is hard. The melody's abstract and you know, obtuse and angular and weird, you know, compared to some of the more well-known tunes. And the chord changes are also weird. A tune like Lush Life, which goes all over the place, which I love the tune, but it took me about 3 months to learn it.
Wow.
Because it goes so many different keys and moves around a lot.
But once you've learned a really complicated tune, then your repertoire is expanded. Your repertoire
of
what you can conceive of.
Yes, it helps in that respect. But it also gives you another great tune to play. So, you know, the more of those you have, the better off.
Yes, it does.
But getting back to, we're kind of going in roundabouts here. But so I started out on those toy keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I would try to play whatever caught my attention. Try to work on it and learn to play it.
What did your family think of this?
They encouraged it to a point, although both of my parents were working people.
Mm-hmm. Not musicians.
We lived in a mill town up in New Hampshire, Nashua, New Hampshire, which used to be a mill town with a lot of the... My dad, worked in a tannery for 20 years.
Mm.
And he did all kinds of other jobs, too. And both my parents worked until very late in life. They didn't have the kinds of resources, the kinds of money to go out and buy me a grand piano.
Right.
They couldn't. That was out of the question.
But they bought you something to play with.
Toy pianos, toy accordions, mm-hmm. toy pump organ. And then when I was about 6 years old and I was getting ready to attend the Perkins School for the Blind, a neighbor of ours had an old upright, which they weren't using, and they gave it to us.
Oh.
So that I was thrilled. It wasn't a great instrument, but all the keys worked.
Mm-hmm.
And curiously enough, now that I think back on it, though, it was one of those old, big, tall uprights that you see in a lot of the, if you've seen pictures or been to a lot of the older clubs in New York, the older, smaller jazz clubs, a lot of them had those big old uprights,
mm-hmm.
like the ones that Art Tatum would play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're as tall as I am when I'm standing up,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it all worked, but curiously enough, it couldn't be brought up to pitch because it was so old.
Oh.
So it was a half tone flat, which meant that for me to play in the key of C, so it would sound like the key of C, I had to play in D flat. So I had that challenge to deal with all the time, too. And so once then, I attended the Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Mass., which is a suburb of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fourth grade, the way things worked at Perkins when I went there, everybody took piano lessons starting in the fourth grade. Everybody took part in the chorus, whether you could sing or not, or whether you could play or not, you took lessons or you took part in the chorus.
Wow.
That's just the way it was. Those things weren't up for negotiation.
Wow. Do you have an idea why?
Well, it was a private school. They could make their own regulations.
Yeah, absolutely.
For one thing.
Right. They could do what they wanted.
And I'm very thankful that I got that early exposure to music. In the third grade, I started learning how to read Braille music, which I don't use anymore. I learn everything by ear, as I said, now, because it's just more immediate. And the Braille music, a lot of the things, that the tunes that I would be interested in learning aren't available in Braille music anyway. That's not a viable option. So at Perkins, I had 4 years of piano lessons. And
well, you must have been ahead of the game.
In some respects, but when I left Perkins after the eighth grade, I went to Bishop Girton High School in my hometown,
mm-hmm.
which is a college prep Catholic high school that's run by the Brothers of the Sacred Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out how far behind the eight ball I was once I started attending a college prep high school. when my assignments would carry me from the time I get home until 11 o'clock at night with a break for supper. Just
okay,
to get
we're,
my homework
we're talking about academics.
Academics, yes.
Yeah.
I was way behind.
Yeah, I was. When I said you were ahead, I meant...
Musically, yeah. I had a rudimentary knowledge of some things like intervals and chords. Although I didn't often know the names of them, I knew what majors and minors sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
But
oh my gosh! So your high school must have been a lot of work.
It was 4 years of hard work, mm-hmm. just to keep up. And my mother went back to school practically. You know, she kept her job, but after she got home from work, guess what she did? Cracked the books and tried to help me with my homework. And
so did you have Braille?
I had some Braille, and I had some books recorded on reel-to-reel tape.
Oh, my goodness.
So I learned, that was when I really started getting into working with alternative. Because one thing we haven't mentioned here, although people who know me and have seen me in Sarasota or Cape Cod or wherever I've played know that I am totally blind.
Yeah.
And I'm not at all uncomfortable about talking about that. Because that's just reality for
no,
me.
It's
it has always been
life.
That way. It
right.
is a fact of life.
Yeah. I didn't say it because I thought it was yours to say.
Well, as you can see, I don't have a problem talking about it. It has posed some interesting challenges for sure. But there, fortunately, even back when I was in high school, people thought of the idea of recording books on tape.
Mm-hmm.
So I got used to the books that weren't available in Braille, and many of them weren't,
mm-hmm.
and couldn't be prepared in time
right.
for the next year or whenever they were needed. My vocational rehab counselors up in the state of New Hampshire, you know, put together a list of people to record books on tape for me.
Oh.
So that's how I got through high school, and that's largely how I got through college. Let me get back to high school now. Bishop Girton High School, my junior year, I can remember this as, I don't remember exactly what date this happened, but I got a call to play my first gig.
Oh, my God.
My junior year in high school, I got a call from the brother of a classmate of mine who played trumpet in a small combo in town. And he called, and this was a Saturday afternoon, and he called and he said, Mike, I know you play the piano because my brother tells me all about you, and I've heard you play. Our regular piano player got sick tonight. Could you play a gig tonight? I didn't even know what a gig was. I said, well, what's that? What is it? You know, what do you mean? I said, well, we got this party, this bowling banquet that we've been hired to play, and, you know, could you? So he read off a list of a bunch of songs that they usually played, and I said, well, I know all of these well enough to get through them. That won't be the same as your regular piano player, but I'll do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first music gig.
Oh,
that was my first
God.
Paying gig.
So how was it?
It was a ball, and we got fed, too. And I got home, I'll never forget it, I got home with a bill of paper currency in my pocket. It was a cash payment, and it was $10. And that was big money back in 1967 for a high school kid to go out and play music. I thought I was thrilled.
You know, I want to stop you for a second because I want to say, of course, this is radio, so you can't see, but Mike is as delighted now, I think, almost as he must have been at the time.
Oh, it's
part of his charm is how immediate his pleasure is. And you hear it when he's playing. You hear this delight that's coming through him, you know, into the keys. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop you.
No, I'm glad. No, it's, one thing I tell a lot of I tell all my students this at one time or another, and I teach private students here, and I also teach, I'm the adjunct instructor of jazz piano at Manatee Community College, and my college students come here for lessons also, because I'm set up to record and all that, you know. And as you saw when you came in the music room, I have a Mason and Hamlin Grand, and I have a Yamaha Electronic set up, too. So if we need to play on two pianos, we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
It works very well, for the most part. But one thing I tell all my students, at one time or another, or many times if need be, is that playing music has to be fun first. If it's fun first, everything else will take care of itself in due time.
Yes, I believe it. And
it really works.
You know, and you practice what you preach. You live what you say. It's so clear.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, Mike, my God. Okay, so you got that gig. And
so I got that gig, and then, I really got a kick out of that.
I'll bet.
We had a great meal. We had a lot of, fun hanging out on the breaks, and I got through all the tunes alive, no major disasters.
And you thought, this is not a bad thing.
This is pretty good. I could do this sometimes, you know. Then
up until then, had you thought what you might do?
I actually originally, when I was in high school, one of my strong subjects in high school was French.
Oh.
And I was thinking about majoring in French in college and minoring in government with the idea of being a translator or an interpreter for either the U.S. government or the U.N. or the diplomatic service or something.
Right.
But all that changed my freshman year in college. When I was a freshman at Dartmouth College back in 1967-68, a guy that lived in the room next door to me in the dorm I lived in played Oscar Peterson's Night Train album for me one night, and I just flipped out. I said, oh my God, this is what I've been looking for a long time. And I made up my mind at that point I was at least going to explore the possibility of majoring in music.
Oh, my.
So I got into jazz piano rather late in the game compared to a lot of people.
Yes, you did.
If you stop and think about it.
And so, now again, your parents are paying for you to go to, you know.
Well, I got they helped. But fortunately, because I had gotten straight A's in high school, through all that hard work, which I alluded to a while ago, I still remember it as clear as day, how long those days were, and but I don't regret doing it for a minute. It's just, but it was it wasn't the kind of life that a normal high school student lives, you know, nowhere near. I had to work real hard to get those grades. But I knew darn well that I wanted to go to a good college when I got out of high school, not just any college.
Right.
And I ended up going to Dartmouth College.
A good college.
Very good college. And I got a scholarship because my grades in my achievement test scores were so good.
Yeah. What I was going to ask was, when your parents heard that you were...
They were in a little bit in a state of shock.
I'll bet they were. Here they had a translator and a diplomatic corps, and
I was going to try to learn how to interpret music.
Yeah, right.
Rather than a spoken language, I was going to try to learn how to interpret the music language in a way that worked for me.
Yeah, it's very similar, but I'm sure for your parents it's...
But their first one of their first reactions was, how do you think you're going to make a living doing this? Do you realize how unstable this profession is?
Right.
They had been around long enough to know.
Right.
And, my answer to them was, well, you know, if I don't at least explore it, I will kick myself for the rest of my life for not having done it.
And they understood that.
They understood that.
Good for them.
And I made an appointment during my freshman year with the chairman of the music department, who has since passed away. But he was an organist, and he taught music theory, and he heard me practicing on one of the Steinway pianos that was readily available in the student lounge. And he was very open and honest about it. He said, I'll tell you what, he said, the music major here at Dartmouth is not really performance-oriented at this point. Mm-hmm. It's a liberal arts, music theory, music history kind of major, mostly. Mm-hmm. If you can take lessons, but at this point, the way it's set up, we don't give academic credit for the lessons, even though you have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can study privately if that's what you want to do, you know, and it will cost you, you know, whatever it was. And then he said, well, I have to tell you something else. He said, we have never had a blind music major here.
Wow.
So that's going to be different for us. It's going to be a challenge. But he was very willing to at least explore the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fall of 1968, I took my first college-level music course, which was elementary harmony, with the Glee Club director, who also taught theory and whatever, you know, counterpoint and various courses. And he was one of the key people in really helping me absorb the language and learn it a lot faster, because a couple of weeks into the class, after class, he said, Mike, do you have a few minutes? I said, yeah, I have a couple of minutes before I have to go. Well, what do you have in mind? He said, well, how do you think you're grasping the material? Do you think you're understanding the terminology? And the, you know, I said, well, you know, as doing as well as I can, I'm taking notes. And
it's really hard.
Well, it can be, but... But he said, how would you feel about this? He said, I have in mind one of our best students who's already had this course. He's a very advanced student. He knows his stuff. How would you feel if he tutored you and recorded keyboard examples for you and did whatever along that to help you learn them? I said, wow. This teacher really took an interest in me. He didn't have to do it.
I have tears in my eyes.
He didn't have to do it.
That's right.
And I was almost speechless, you know.
I'm sure, because I'm crying.
His name was Paul Zeller, and I said, Paul, I really appreciate this. This is the first time that a professor has taken this much interest, and it means a lot to me, and I will do everything I can to learn this as well as I can, you know.
Yes.
And when I took the exam, I got my first B at Dartmouth College in elementary harmony. So, and that whole year, my sophomore year, I really prayed hard and thought hard about what it was going to mean to try to embark on a music career. Mm-hmm. And as sure as I'm sitting here, one night I was debating what to do, tossing it and turning it around, you know, in my mind. And as sure as I'm sitting here, I heard this voice. Michael, I know you're way behind the eight ball compared to people who have played piano seriously for 10 or 12 years and have studied a lot of theory and all that, but you have the means to do this, and I will see to it that you are able to do it if you just plunge into it.
Oh, Michael.
So I said, okay, there's my answer. That's all I need to know.
Oh.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it the best shot I have, and wherever it leads me, at least I will have been able to say I gave it the best shot I could.
Right.
Wow. Well, I don't know whether you got chills, but I got chills. That's probably the closest I'm going to get to a cliffhanger. And I had to split this interview in two because it was so long, and it seemed to me that was the very perfect place to stop the first half of this interview. So I hope that you, like me, were dying to know how it went and what he did and what became of him. And that's what the second half of the interview will say next week. And now, before I close the show, I'm going to play two more songs from Mike's CD, Solid. I'm going to play It Might As Well Be Spring, in which he opens with a drum solo by his drummer, Tony Martin. And also, you can hear his bass player, Billy Pillicherry. And then I'm going to play another example of Mike's whimsy. He is so delightful and delighted. So I'm going to play a piano solo version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And now, here, Mike and Ensemble, It Might As Well Be Spring. Thank you. Wow. Wasn't that terrific? I told you. And next week, you can look forward to more and more of that, and actually a very special example of Mike's genius and also his sense of humor when I play Blues for Joe Green, which is an homage to a piece by Giuseppe Verdi, otherwise known as Joe Green. Who would think of that except Mike? So I'm going to close the show now, and then we're going to go out on Take Me Out to the Ball Game. This is particularly appropriate for me because we've got a little AA team here in Sarasota, Florida. And for a number of years when I was really struggling with my life, I bought season tickets. It was quite remarkable, actually. There were 70 home games, and the season cost $70. That was a dollar a ticket, which was really pretty much all I could afford at the time. And I went to ball games two, three, four times a week whenever they were here. And actually, someday I will tell you more about that. It was an amazing experience for me. But right now, suffice it to say, I have a soft spot in my heart for anything related to baseball. And so we're going to ride out on the show on the wings of Mike playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But before I stop, let me once again thank Josh Hackney, who is the person who literally makes this show possible by saving me from whatever technological catastrophes I bring upon myself and whatever technological catastrophes the world brings to me through no fault of my own. And my God, no matter what, no matter how careful I am, almost every week there is something I don't understand or something goes wrong, and Josh rides to the rescue. So if you are like me and you are in love with the technology and want to use the technology in one form or another, but are not young and didn't cut your teeth on it, or, you know, it's just not your thing, or maybe you really are accomplished, but there are new things you want to try, new things you want to add, and you just want a little assistance. And if you do anything with recording, then Josh is the guy you want to have at your back or in front of you or at your side. You just want to know he's there. And so if you do, then you should go up on my website, and I will take this opportunity to say again that the website is thelynshow.com. That's thelynneshow. If you leave the E out, you get somebody else. And that you can not only find Josh on my website, but you can tell me that you'd like to get a hold of Mike, either to get his CD or have him come play for you. He plays concerts and parties, and he teaches. So anything related to piano, you want to get Mike, you can get all those people at my website. And anybody else that you heard interviewed on my show, if you haven't written down their email address or their website, you can check out the book, the workbook, the audiobook. You can find the CD from which the first song and the last song that I played on this show come. You can find out about all the other things that I do, anything. And you can listen to the old shows. You just click on new podcasts. It's something of a misnomer. They're all old shows, but you can find them there too. So, as always, I hope that you got something useful from this show, or something entertaining, or something engaging, something that made you glad you listened and made you want to come back next week and listen again, because I will be here then. And boy, I sure hope you will be too. Thank you. Tune in again next week, when I'll continue to talk about our unconscious and tell you about its most clever trick, that of camouflage. And I'll interview Elliot Roth, a delightful, new, pretty young jazz pianist.
I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper, I may have got the